Welcome to Special Sauce, Serious Eats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike.
I did cook for the Obamas, and I can't believe people are still talking about it 8 years later.
This week, our guest is Missy Robbins, chef owner of one of the best, I guess I call it newish at this point, Italian restaurants in the country. Do I say Lilia?
Yes, Lilia.
Missy has taken an unusual path to co-owning her own restaurant. I'm sure she broke her parents' heart by deciding to become a chef after graduating from Georgetown, majoring in art history and minoring in psychology. It couldn't have been a total surprise to them, as Missy worked at the influential Washington, D.C. restaurant 1789 while she was still in college. She then went to culinary school, and after working at Sirius restaurants in New York, she ended up traveling in northern Italy to get a firmer grounding in Italian food. She used what she soaked up there in Chicago, working as the executive chef at the Obamas' favorite occasion restaurant, Spiaggia. Missy came to New York and eventually earned Michelin stars running the kitchens at the two branches of Avoce. In 2013, she shocked the cooking world by quitting Avoce and taking a self-imposed sabbatical from the stoves. She returned with a vengeance in 2016, opening the 72-seat, that includes the bar, Lilia, which is on everyone's short list of places you have to eat if you're serious about pasta and very personal Italian food. Here to talk about art history, the woman's place in restaurant kitchens, burnout, and how to personalize Italian food is the great Missy Robbins. It's so good to have you here.
It's so great to be here. Thank you.
And Missy, I still have to admit that I have not tried the lobster roll place that you told me about near your parents' house.
You're missing out. You are missing out.
It's in the. Did you say it's in the train station or
no,
something?
No, it's across from a train station, like a 5-minute walk behind a boat yard on a, like, I don't know if it's a canal. I don't know what it is.
And you never told me the
My
name.
My parents don't live there anymore, though, unfortunately.
Oh, okay, really?
So they moved, so I don't go there anymore.
But you're assuming the place is still there?
No, the place is there, yeah, for sure.
Okay, good. Let's talk about the Robbins family table growing up.
Sure.
What was that like?
My mom is an incredible entertainer. I like to call her the Jewish Martha Stewart.
who is, in fact, Jewish.
Good point. We did every holiday at my house. We ate dinner at home every night almost. I wouldn't call my mother the most extraordinary cook in the world, but she's an incredible entertainer. Tables were set impeccably. Her china's impeccable. There are flowers in every room of our house. When you go home to visit, there's flowers in your bedroom. There's chocolates on the bed. It's like going to a hotel. My mom grew up in the hotel business.
Really?
Yeah, my family owned a resort in Wisconsin.
Wow.
Kind of a old school Kutcher's Dirty Dancing kind of place.
In the Lake District
up
there. Yeah.
And my mom grew up there. They went every summer. They sold it when I was very young, probably like 1 or 2 years old. I have very distinct, odd memories of it. It's weird that I remember it.
That is weird.
It's
at one
very,
or two?
Very, I'm not, I have very distinctive memories. So entertaining and food and holidays and all that stuff were really big in my family. My mom has her specialties, chicken soup, brisket, meatloaf, like those kind of things were her thing. She has really learned a lot from me in the last 20 years. She sends pictures all the time of what she's cooking at home. It's really cute. She like uses lemon zest a lot now, and she gets it more. She might use a little salt now. She definitely didn't use salt growing up. And I want to go back to your comment about my parents being heartbroken when I went home to tell them I was going to be a chef. They were not. They have been the most supportive two people.
Wow.
I started cooking my last semester senior year, and I blame them, by the way. They took me all over the place to eat. It was a meal at Charlie Trotter's that kind of sealed the deal for me my senior
really?
Year of college, and I said, oh, I want to do
Charlie
this.
Charlie Trotter, who just died.
Yes.
One of the great figures in American cooking.
I would not be a chef without having eaten at Charlie Trotter's.
Wow.
I ate there my senior year in November during Thanksgiving weekend for my brother's birthday. My grandmother's from Chicago, so we used to go there. And that's how I ended up doing it. And when I went home after I started cooking in college and I said, I'd like to try this for a year and I'm kind of going to need some financial support. I made $7 an hour, not even hitting 40 hours a week all the time.
Just to tell you that when my son started a talent agency in L.A. 4 years ago, $10 an hour.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, so my parents, they said, okay. They said, all right, we'll help you if this is what you really want to do. And I think I always took it really seriously. I didn't kind of get into the partying thing. I went to work early every day to learn more. I was really into it. And they have never, ever, ever tried to discourage me.
That's great. So it wasn't like, oh, you mean we wasted, you know, $100,000 on your education at Georgetown?
No, not one day.
Wow.
Not one day, ever. I think if I had screwed up or if I hadn't continually kept improving and working hard, they may have. They were supportive when I came home and said I wanted to go to Italy. They funded it. It was supposed to be a loan. I still owe my father a lot of money. It's coming. It's coming soon.
Dad, it's coming.
It's coming. My parents had a really cool philosophy. My father did not grow up wealthy. He put himself through college and medical school at Georgetown also. And their philosophy on education was always really incredible. They're not, you know, they're not from a generation where you kind of just do whatever you want to do. But I have an older brother, and neither of us did they ever push my father's a physician, pre-med or pre-law or pre-anything. They just said, go get educated. You're going to have great skills. You'll know how to write. You'll know how to analyze.
And you'll figure it out.
And you'll figure it out. They never. So I think it really was helpful to both of us. My brother has a very normal path, normal career. He's not.
It's funny. We did the same thing with our son. It was just like, we didn't say, oh, go be a lawyer, go be a doctor. Just find out what you love. And, you know, there's that old saw about if you love what you do, you don't work a day in your life.
Yeah. And I think my parents just saw that I loved it. And obviously I've done well. And I think they're very proud.
Yeah. And they saw your focus more, you know, and they saw how conscientious you were approaching this.
I was 42 when I decided to leave Avoce. And even at 42, you're kind of terrified to tell your parents that you're going to not work. And they never said a word. I mean, they
really?
Didn't. No, they didn't say, are you crazy? Are you like, what are you doing? They just said, OK, go figure it out. Do what you want to do.
Yeah.
I mean, at that point, I wasn't asking them for money, but they've always been very supportive of
anything.
And
do you feel that that your time spent at Georgetown studying art history and psychology, do you feel like it was wasted time, or do you
No. And I encourage young high school students who come to me and say, I want to go to cooking school or I want to do this. I very, very strongly encourage everyone to go to college. I think it's a social experience, first of all, that's very important. And it forms you socially in many ways. You're away from home. And I think it also just gives you the skills. If for some reason cooking hadn't worked out for me, or after a year or two I said, this life's not for me, I don't want to do this, I had the degree to go do whatever I wanted to do, or go to grad school and whatever, study business or whatever I wanted to do, or go back and do art history, which was never really something I was interested in. But especially where I went to college, my major was such a minor part of my
experience.
Education there.
Yeah.
I happened to pick a major that just wasn't that intense, not because it wasn't intense, just because I was interested in art. But it just, Georgetown is a very well-rounded school, and there's so many requirements to get through your education there that you end, I mean, philosophy, theology, English, history, all that stuff. And so I think you just end up a really well-rounded, educated person. And more so. And I also went to a very intense high school.
Oh, you went? Did you go to Hopkins?
I went to Hopkins in
New
Haven.
My nieces went to Hopkins.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Who are your nieces? Do I know them?
They're
much younger, right? But Hopkins was hard, but they really focus on literature and writing. And
we should say that Hopkins is a very, very formidable day school.
Yeah.
Outside New Haven.
Yeah. No, in New Haven.
In New Haven.
So I think just my education in general kind of
Got
was
it.
Always a big focus, and I don't think it was wasted it all. And at the time that I became a chef, it wasn't an option to go to college. I mean, I grew up in a home where going to college wasn't like, do you want to go to college or not? It was right. just you went to this very competitive high school and then you went to college. It wasn't a discussion. It was where are you going to college and how the hell are you going to get into college?
Exactly. Yes. It was the same way with me. It wasn't a discussion. So the first restaurant you worked in was 1789, which was right near the Georgetown campus. And where the chef that at least put it on the map, I don't know if she was the opening chef, was a woman.
Yeah,
right?
She was there after me.
She was there after you.
I worked for a guy named Mike, and he was awesome. He was very young, and I'm totally blanking on his last name, which is terrible. But he gave me a chance. I mean, I literally knocked on the door there. The 1789 is very important to recognize. It was above my college bar, the Tombs, and owned by the same company. And so I would see the chefs at the Tombs all the time, and I spent many, many nights a week at the Tombs.
I'm sure just studying.
Yes, studying.
Studying the alcohol content of different beers.
Exactly. It's a very long story, but I had really wanted – I found out a friend of mine that I went to elementary school with – went to Northwestern and was cooking at Charlie Trotter's. And before I kind of heard that, going to college and then becoming a chef wasn't a thing then.
Yeah.
And so I didn't even think it was possible. I thought I had this real interest in the restaurant business, but I thought I'd go do something else and become wealthy doing something and open a restaurant in later in life as a hobby. Little did I know it's not a hobby. And and that's for anyone. For anyone.
Right.
I kind of, once I heard that she was cooking at Trotter's, I said, that's where I'm going to cook. And I called her. I hadn't talked to her in years. And I called her and she said, he's not going to answer you, just so you know. Like, you can write him a letter. It was before texting, email, any of that stuff. She said, you can write him a letter. I just don't think he'll respond. I knocked on the door a lot. I lived in Chicago, whatever. I wrote him a letter, long cover letter, like we used to write.
Heartfelt.
Three weeks later, he called me. I was getting ready to go out. It was a Thursday night, and my roommate yelled upstairs to me and said, hey, some guy named Charlie's on the phone. And I was like, huh? And I was like, oh, no. And I got on the phone, and he grilled me. And he said, why don't you come out here and spend a few days in my kitchen, and we'll go from there. So my grandmother had an apartment in Chicago still.
Wow.
I took a week off of Georgetown. I flew out there. I spent 2 days in his kitchen. He wouldn't really give me an answer.
You probably didn't speak to
him. I showed up. You knock on the back door. He answers the door. He said, aren't you supposed to be here next week? And, like, your heart drops. I'm a 22-year-old kid. And he said, just kidding. It was, like, not funny. I spent 2 days there. They were terrifying. We kept in touch. He said, why don't you go work for Jean-Louis Peladen while you're in D.C.?
Famous D.C. restaurateur also passed away.
But was the top of his game then.
Yes, influential figure in American cooking.
So, you know, being naive, I went and dropped off a resume at the Watergate Hotel where he had his restaurant. And he did get back to me. And he said, I don't have room in my kitchen right now, but thank you for your application. And so that's how I ended up going to 1789, because I said, Charlie's wants me to get experience while I'm finishing school, which I thought was ridiculous. I was a senior in college.
Sure.
I went to 1789. They said, okay, you can work Fridays and Saturday nights. I said, Fridays and Saturday nights? No way. Like,
those are party nights.
Yeah, I said, no, I'm a senior in college. And they said, okay, Friday and Saturday night, be here at 4. And I went on that first Friday, and I loved it. I fell in love with it. And I was like, wow, this is really fun.
It's better than partying.
I didn't look at my watch. You were occupied for 8 hours. And there was a back door to the bar. So I could go downstairs to the bar, and my friends were there when I was done. And I finished school, and Charlie still hadn't given me an answer. And I was getting frustrated. Like, I needed a plan. I needed to tell my parents where I was going to work. And I was also going to travel for the summer in Europe with a friend. And I went to the guys at 1789. These guys told me how to hold a knife. They showed me how to make a vinaigrette. I mean, every basic, how to saute, every basic of cooking. And I was really learning a lot. And I liked them. They were really nice. And I went to them and I said, listen, I have plans to travel, but I'd really like to come back here when I'm done. And they said, great, go eat food in Europe. Enjoy yourself. Come back in August. We'll have a job for you. And I stayed for almost another year after
that. Before you went to cooking
school. Before I came to New York, yeah.
Yeah. And then you went to work for Anne Rosenzweig, another who's still very much alive, but a forgotten figure and very, very important for woman chefs in America. Did it make a difference? Did you understand more about the obstacles you would face being a woman in a kitchen working
for Anne?
Well,
let's start with this. I didn't face obstacles. And it's something very important because it's not a topic I like to discuss. I think the whole woman chef thing is it's an important topic on many levels, but it's a non-issue for me in many things. I put my head down. I worked. The first kitchen I worked in D.C. was nine guys and me. I was the only woman there. And there were guys who didn't understand why I was there and why I wasn't home making babies and like strange things like that. But I also proved myself and I worked really hard. And I was influenced to go work for Anne because I definitely saw a connection. She was an anthropologist.
Very smart woman.
Yeah. Oh, brilliant. She had just gotten 3 stars in the New York Times, and that's how I found out about her. I had just started cooking, and she had gotten her 3-star review, which was a very big deal. And so I definitely targeted her to go work there.
But more because of the place.
I think more because of the background.
Yes.
She was a Jewish woman who went to Columbia. I just kind of felt like there
was
a
simpatico.
A little bit, yeah. And that was interesting to me, and it wasn't about like, oh, I really want to go work for a woman. I never really felt that. I did feel that it was important to work in kitchens where I felt comfortable. Mm-hmm. And I staged other places before I took the job. That was the place that I definitely felt the most comfortable. I would say her staff was probably 50% women, 50% men at the time. Her chef de cuisine, Tony, for many, many years was a guy. So it wasn't like there was this like rah-rah woman thing. I felt like this kind of synergy with Anne, and I liked her. She was tough, very, very tough.
Yes, and
she's
Anne
still
talks
tough
about,
on me now, 20 years later.
Anne talks about when she started working in kitchens that she was hazed because she's tiny.
Oh, she's very tiny.
And they would say, okay, you know, see that huge stock pot? You know, bring it over here.
Yeah, I don't ever felt like I got hazed any more than anyone new in a kitchen gets
everyone
hazed.
Everyone gets hazed.
Less so now. That behavior kind of doesn't, at least in my kitchens, doesn't really exist. There's ribbing, there's joking, there's making fun of each other, but there's not hazing. And I don't feel like I ever really, really got hazed. I feel like I was very deliberate in picking my early kitchen. So I picked Anne's kitchen, and Anne's kitchen wasn't easy. I got yelled at more in Anne's kitchen than any kitchen I've worked in. For a 5'1" woman, she's
she had a loud
she's
voice.
She's intense. Yes, she's intense. And I was also 24. I was a little shit. I mean, I was 24 years old. I was working at the beginning. I worked days. I had to be at work at 8 a.m. I went out every night. I was 24 years old.
You were living the life of a young working chef.
Exactly. Cook. Very.
Cook.
I was a young working cook, and I was having a lot of fun. And it was tough, and I learned a lot. I mean, I really learned a lot from her. But I also went on to pick kitchens that were always kind of very mixed, male and female. I like that. I like it in my own kitchen. I don't want all women in my kitchen at all. I don't want all guys in my kitchens at all. I want kind of a balance. I think it's important. I think it feeds off of each other. I think there are different personalities. I think there's just a different approach, and I like that. But most importantly, I picked sort of kitchens where I felt like I could thrive and I wasn't going to be uncomfortable. And I it was more about that. I worked for Wayne Nish for 2 years.
At a great restaurant called March and then many other
restaurants.
I know,
I'm so old school. Like, these restaurants don't even exist.
I have to explain on special sauce who
they are.
My cooks
today don't even know who I worked for. They don't understand it. I talk about people. It's so sad. But March was incredible. I mean, March is really what taught me the real principles of fine dining and really that tasting menu kind of vernacular. And I loved March so much. He was ahead of his time. He was doing innovative stuff before other people. And that kitchen was a really tight kitchen. It was very small. That when I was there, it was before he renovated, and there were only maybe seven full-time kitchen employees. And
turning out really elaborate food.
Yeah, well, there were also like 10 interns at a time working over sinks and cutting boards. And I was one of those interns at one point.
Right.
I did my internship there before I worked for Anne. And I loved it. But it was very deliberate, me kind of picking kitchens. And I remember when I left my externship and Wayne didn't have any positions at the time in the kitchen, I went to him and I said, here's the list of restaurants that I'm thinking of. And he kind of had gotten to know me pretty well. And he looked at them and he would point and say, that's not for you. You won't like it. Go there. You'll love it. Like, and he really helped me in that.
That's great.
Yeah.
So then after working in these kitchens, you chucked it all and went to Italy.
I wouldn't say I chucked it all, but I had gone.
I just mean you made a series of turns.
Yeah. Georgetown has a villa in Italy outside of Florence in Fiesole for art history program, and I was supposed to go there my junior year, and I kind of chickened out. I had transferred to Georgetown my sophomore year, and I got into this program to go to for a semester to Italy, and I said, oh, well, my friends are all transfers and no one's leaving. And I kind of decided not to go last minute. And I always regretted it a lot. And I was approaching the end of my 20s when I decided to go to Italy for the second time. And I sort of said, like, if I don't do this now, I'm never going to do it. And I was working for Anne again at the Lobster Club. I had left for 2 years to go work for Wayne.
Second restaurant.
Yeah. And I had gone back as a sous chef, and it was a very, very intense job. And I was probably facing a little bit of burnout. And I knew that I really wanted to do this cooking abroad thing. And I had this kind of thing that I needed to get out of my system. And it was awesome. I mean, it was the first time I was really independent. I couldn't call a friend to make decisions. I had no one. I was just there alone without a cell phone at the time. And I had email, but I had to go to like email cafes. And,
right.
And I was working with Italians in Italian kitchens, living with Italians. And I was like really fully immersed in it.
And how did you get the job? Did you just knock on doors?
Anne helped me, actually.
Oh,
Anne and her husband, Andy, had some connections, and they helped me with the first two places. And Italians are just so hospitable that the second three places I went kind of just came from other people. So Wayne, for instance, had set me up in a 2-star Michelin restaurant. I had a lot of trouble getting in touch with them. And by the time I got in touch with them, they said they didn't have enough room in their kitchen. That guy sent me to Friuli. They're just hospitable. So,
how many places did you end up working at in Italy?
I worked in four, I think. One, two, three, four.
In a year?
No. I was only there for 5 months.
5 months.
I traveled part of it. One place only lasted 2 weeks. I went back to the first place. They laughed. They knew I wasn't going to like the second place. They didn't want to say anything. I called them after 2 weeks. I said, can I please come back? They said yes.
Got it.
And then, so I worked in everything from trattorias to Michelin star restaurant.
Wow.
It was a really unbelievable experience.
So you come back to the States.
I worked in New York for another 3.5 years. So I came back, and it's so funny. I was getting all these offers for Italian places, and I'm like, I'm not an Italian chef. Like, I don't know enough. And I also didn't want to be pigeonholed into one culture of cooking.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't ready yet. And I was getting offers in similar. I interviewed at Felidia, and
which was the first important northern Italian restaurant.
Yeah, I interviewed there. I didn't end up working there. I interviewed at Tocqueville, but those restaurants were very similar to the places I had worked. And I was sort of in this adventurous spirit, having just come back from this foreign experience. And I had applied in Vegas and all over. I was willing to move, but I ended up. This is like a little known fact about me, which is funny because it's important. I worked at the Soho Grand Hotel for 3.5 years.
Wow.
I ran into John DeLucy on the street. He said, oh, I just became the executive chef of the Soho Grand. Come be my sous chef. And I was like, yeah, no, I'm not going to go work at a hotel. And he's like, well, just come talk to me. And I don't know if you know John well or not.
Yes,
but
I do.
John is, I like to call him positively manipulative.
That's fair.
I think it's a good quality of his. And he's special that way. And we had all these talks. And he somehow convinced me to go work there. And at the time, it was like a hot place.
Yeah.
And I just thought, like, oh, I've never worked downtown in a hip place before. I've never worked in a hotel. Maybe I'm missing something. I learned that I wasn't really missing anything, but I kept getting promoted there. I went from like the junior sous chef to the sous chef to the exec sous chef, and eventually John became the chef of the Tribeca Grand and the Soho Grand, so he put chef de cuisines in place, so I became the chef de cuisine. But I was never happy cooking there, but I was learning. First of all, John DeLucy taught me how to be nice. Nicer. He's a really great manager, and he treats people with a ton of dignity. And I spent a lot of time getting my hand slapped in HR, so that was interesting. I learned a lot about kind of the financial picture. Once I became the chef de cuisine, I sat in P&L meetings with the top execs at the Soho Grand. I just learned kind of more management stuff, but I knew that I really kind of missed fine dining. And I spent a lot of time looking for jobs. But
did you know that you weren't nice, particularly?
I don't know if it's nice, the word
maybe
nice.
A strong
I don't know
word.
If the word not nice. I
you
was a tough
civil.
Manager who didn't know how to listen and didn't know how to talk to people properly.
Yeah.
And by the way,
because I've always found you to be nice.
And by I'm very nice. I have had a reputation of being tough in the kitchen. I have even changed quite a bit in the last 3 years, taking time off from Aboche, and we can get to that as a topic, but taking that time off changed me dramatically. If you talk to the people who work for me now that worked for me before, I am a different chef.
Yeah, and a different person in many ways.
Yeah, yeah, and a better version of myself. I don't know that not being nice is the right word.
Yeah.
I'm nice.
Yeah.
I was a tough manager, and I didn't always know how to handle situations. And I think John was certainly the beginning of that. And Tony Montuano, who I worked for in Spiaggia.
He was the executive chef at Spiaggia in Chicago.
He's the partner, yeah. And he's amazing. I mean, he also is just the nicest person. And so I got a call from a headhunter when I was at the Soho Grand, and he said, you know, you told me 3 years ago that you would move to Chicago. Is that still true? And I'm like, I don't know. And he said, well, have you heard of Spiaggia? They're looking for a chef to work with Tony. And I said, yeah, my parents just ate there, actually. I'd be happy to talk to him, whatever. I really wanted to get back into fine dining, and I knew that there was no way that in New York I would get the kind of job in Chicago because I had just taken myself so far out of that scene. And I had a phone conversation with Tony on a Sunday morning that lasted 2 hours, and we had such an amazing conversation. I had eaten in all the places that he worked before he opened Spiaggia. And I had kind of this package. I understood big operations from working in the hotel. So that's why that hotel situation has become such an important factor, because I would have never gotten the job
at
Spiaggia.
Yeah, and they do a lot of covers at Spiaggia. There are a lot of different aspects.
Well, it's also part of a giant company, and you have to know how to use a computer, and you have to know how to deal with the corporate overhead people, and you have to know how to kind of work within a larger organization. And having worked at the hotel and having the fine dining experience in New York and having lived in Italy were sort of the perfect combination for him. So he flew me out there after this conversation, and I did a tasting, and I moved 6 weeks later.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's crazy. And then, you know, Spiaggia was the play. It was the special occasion restaurant. And if you were at Spiaggia, you know, at a certain period, you had to have cooked for the Obamas.
I did cook for the Obamas, and I can't believe people are still talking about it 8 years later.
I know. It's weird. It's like you'll probably have to answer that question.
I'm not even sure that the Obamas know who I am. I certainly had met them. I certainly cooked for them on nights that Tony was not there. At the time, he was not the president. And I did watch a really cool evolution from him being a senator. I mean, I didn't even know who Obama was when I moved to Chicago. Let's just be clear about that.
Right.
But I watched this really amazing evolution from him being senator to him being a candidate for the presidency, and watching the security detail change over those 5 years, and going from maybe one security detail to five to very, very soon after I left. I left Spiaggia in August of 2008. So, you know, pretty close to it. But after I left, they were using metal detectors on the nights that he was there. So really interesting evolution.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
They were great diners. They were lovely people. They really kind of just did their thing. They had fun. They ate like normal people. They're normal people.
Yeah, that's great.
I'm honored to have cooked for them.
And they still eat at Spiaggia.
They do still eat at Spiaggia. We have not gotten them to Lilia yet. My partner has definitely worked on it.
Right, got it.
We'll get them there someday.
So you come back to New York. you work at Avoce.
Yeah.
Which probably when you got there, there was only one.
There was one. But I was hired to do two. I mean, that was part of the
gig. So it was owned by a restaurant group.
Yes.
And so in a way, you're sort of combining your Spiaggia experience and your Soho Grand experience.
The Soho Grand gave me the foundation to understand
management.
Bigger corporate management structure.
Yeah.
That's basically what it did. And I'm thankful for that because I think it's really important.
Yeah.
And I think it's made me a better chef and a better leader and a better, today, better business owner.
So you succeeded Andrew Carmelini, who is a great chef.
Yes.
And yet you established a reputation in New York from your time at Avoce. You got a Michelin star at both restaurants. You were Food and Wine Best New Chef and all that. So, like, things were pretty good, right? And then, like, you really did chuck it all. I'm going to say that, okay? You chucked it all. You just stopped.
Well, I mean, it wasn't as simple as that.
It was
a long decision-making process. Avoce was incredible for me, and I have nothing bad to say about that experience. They did, and I've said this many times before, they did everything they said they would do for me. They said they would give me kitchens, they said they would give me press, they said they would help me elevate myself in New York. They really gave me a platform, and I took a lot of advantage of that, and really I worked very, very hard there. It was a really, I mean, taking over for Andrew was really tough. I mean, that was probably tougher than opening Lilia and tougher than opening the second Avoce. Andrew was a huge name in New York. Avoce at the time was probably the hottest restaurant in the press. Andrew's whole team was still there when I got there, and they were very loyal to Andrew. And it was a very difficult acclimation for me.
Yeah.
I mean, I called my mother every day for six
really?
Months. Oh my God, every day for 6 months. I would walk through Madison Square Park. I lived in the West Village. I would walk to work every day. I called her, and I was. I don't know if miserable is the right word, but it was very challenging to walk into a kitchen every day where it was your kitchen, but you had this team there who was so loyal to the person that was there before you, and they were just waiting for him to open something.
Right.
And I knew that.
And you knew that, and you couldn't, and yet you
I
couldn't
knew that,
confront
and I respected
them.
It, by
yeah,
the way. And
sure.
I still look at many of those people that were there still work for Andrew today. And I just find it so incredible how loyal his people are to him.
Mm-hmm.
I really respect it. And they all kind of trickled out by February. And once I was able to bring in my own team, things started looking much better. And by the way, his team was probably collectively the most talented group of cooks I've seen in a kitchen. Really incredible. They weren't loyal to me, and they didn't want to work with me. They wanted to work with him. And so once I could bring in my own group, things really looked up. And then we opened Columbus, and that was a big deal and also very stressful. I mean, I knew that all eyes were sort of on that project and what's she going to do and who's
right,
this
girl.
Right, because
this was at the Time Warner Center in Columbus Circle.
Yeah.
It was a big deal. It was the first sort of vertical shopping center in New York.
It was a big deal, and it was one of the things that drew me to the project. I mean, having a restaurant right under Per Se, and at the time, those were all kind of glossy things to me.
Yes.
My vision has changed quite a bit now, but at the time, and we're talking almost 9 years ago when I started Avoce, or eight and a half years ago, my viewpoint was different. What I wanted out of my career was different, and so I wouldn't say I threw it all away. It was a hard decision, and I knew that Avoce wasn't the long-term solution for me. I knew somewhere in my
As
gut.
As a human being.
Yes. I knew somewhere in my gut and my soul, and it had nothing to do with anything really other than me and sort of what I wanted. And I left a very, very good job, and both financially, and I gave up a partnership there, and it wasn't easy. And I remember interviewing with Florence Fabricant for the Times the day before I left, or a couple of days. And at the time, Jennifer Baum was my publicist, and she said, "You have to talk to her yourself." And I said, "I don't want to." And she said, you have to. And Florence kept grilling me and saying, well, you must be going to do something. And I said, I'm not. I'm taking some time off. And she said, well, you must. And finally, I said, well, I'm going to write a book and travel, which was not true. I figured, I figured I would do some traveling. I figured eventually I'd write a book.
So you'd be technically not telling a lie.
It was partially true. I mean, I wanted to write a book and I wanted to travel, but I didn't have definitive plans. But I definitely did not have definitive plans to open a restaurant or go work for someone or anything. I gave 6 months notice at Avoce, which is very, very long. And I wanted them to succeed when I left, and I wanted to set them up to do that. And I really wanted that time to – I didn't want to even think about what I was going to do. I had worked for 20 years without a break, except in between jobs and moving from Chicago to New York, but very short breaks. And I just kind of wanted to breathe, and I said, I'll give myself a year. I'll see what happens. And I really thought – I mean, I've been known to be a workaholic in the past. I think I've cured myself of that also. But I really thought I'd last like through the summer. I left in May. I thought I'd be really eager to get back to work by the end of the summer. And I wasn't. I really loved not working. I was very good at it. And I enjoyed life. And it was really kind of an amazing period for me.
And you really didn't work, and you did some traveling.
I didn't work for the first year, and then I started doing some consulting, and then I found the space for Lilia. But Lilia took 14 months to build out, so it ended up what was supposed to be a year off really turned into kind of 2.5, almost 3 years of really not being in a restaurant environment. I did do a consulting job for Laura Manick. I opened the second Cork Buzz for her, which was amazing. And that kind of held me over for 6 months. But I was really kind of living like a normal civilian for a long time.
And what did you learn? What did you learn in those 2.5 years?
I learned to mellow out.
That's important.
I just learned that I didn't want to work 16 hours a day. I didn't want to be in a stressful environment. I wasn't sure that I actually wanted to open a restaurant. I was hoping for this grand epiphany.
Next week on Special Sauce, the second half of Ed Levine's conversation with chef Missy Robbins, including the birth of her next project, the restaurant Lilia.